Michael Wartowski, Rule Real 5. So we got as far as the fact you got on board the SS Mauritania at Suez. And where were you going to?
Yes. Well, first of all, if I may mention the magnificence of the ship, Mauritania, which was converted into a troop carrier. And to my knowledge, they loaded about 10,000 to 11,000 troops, as a matter of fact. It was quite congested. And we were told, because one learns gradually what's going on, that Mauritania was only used between Suez and Durban, because there were already signs of Japanese submarines appearing in the Pacific. But anyway, we set off on this magnificent ship and appreciated tremendously the functioning of it, in spite of the multitude of so many boys. Didn't see a single girl there, but I mean so many boys. And the way it was functioned and serving even the meals and so on, it was absolutely perfect. Mm. Yes, perfect. There was no... Because my attitude still was rather amateurish towards the military discipline and so on. And whenever they were trying to issue orders and so on, my friend Henry, as I mentioned, my best friend, and I, we were just disappearing somewhere in the crowds, and they could never find us because we just didn't quite absorb the concept of discipline or orders. We were still a little bit, I should say, flamboyant about it. But I remember also when we were sailing along, and Henry and I, we always used to be on the top deck and watching what was going around us. Some boys were sick, strangely enough, and I remember that my friend Hubert was perpetually sick, as a matter of fact, and I always used to sit beside him and ask him whether he was going to eat his meal, and he always used to say no, so I was glad to consume his meals as well. Very naughty, but I mean, that's practical. Then we passed past the equator, and with the equator, there was a ceremony of, well, everybody is familiar with the ceremony at the equator, so I will not dwell upon it too much. We were all given certificates passing the equator. Then we passed between Madagascar and the mainland of Africa and arrived at Durban in South Africa. Well, the whole business of unloading was, again, very efficient. And here, I must say that in spite of the fact that the war was really in the midst of it, and yet it all functioned perfectly. There was no undue sort of disorder or anything, and the military police was always at hand and regulated everything. And when we landed in Durban, and with all our equipment, whatever we had, and those bags and so on. And to my utmost surprise, we were approached all the time by black people. I've never seen so many black people in my life, and we were not allowed to carry it. And to me, it was a bit of a shock, really. I couldn't quite understand it. But they did. They carry all our bags and so on and into the train. And they were most polite about it, and they considered it like slaves in a way. And we were loaded on the trains, and then we proceeded to Pietermaritzburg, a beautiful town in South Africa. And it was going to be our sort of a couple of weeks convalescence because of the whole ordeal of travel from the Soviet Union, that many perished, many suffered. And I must say that the camp, it was a transit camp in Pietermaritzburg, it was absolutely superb. Everything was free. every morning lorries would arrive with fresh fruit and vegetables and marmalade tins. We used to have fights with those marmalade tins, you know. And in town, I remember Naffy and so on, it was almost free for us. Transport was free. And the attitude of the South Africans was tremendous towards our troops. And we had, obviously, exercise and so on. But I was very fortunate that because my group of friends who were, let's put it, they were all educated boys, they formed an army choir. And they asked me, because of my supposedly tenor voice, I joined this choir with my best friends, and therefore I avoided really the bashing, you see. We had practices for 6 hours a day, and nearby we had, a military band. They were practicing as well, and we had many clashes with them because they shouted at you too loud, you know, so get away from us, and we shout, you get away from us. And but it all went wonderfully well. The food was very good, and we even had a free supply of sherry, believe it or not. And it was the first time that I probably got a little bit drunk on an overdose of South African sherry, which was quite potent at my age anyway.
Did you have much contact with the South African people?
Well, yes, we gradually established the choir and the band. When we were ready, as a matter of fact, we started performing within that short period. The first performance we gave was in Pietermaritzburg, for the BBC in London. And we sang, and we learned also the famous South African Sari Marie. If you remember, this is their national sort of song. And then we had to sing God Save the King. But we couldn't really learn the language properly, but we used simply phonetics. So it all went down extremely well. We also had the visit of some relation to General Smuts, and it was quite an occasion, as a matter of fact, because when this young lady arrived in a sort of company of some other ladies as well, and we gave them a special performance. And I was very privileged because I sang solo a little song which my father taught me was that I have to part my son, I'm going into the world, and so on and so on. And the visit was extremely successful, and it also gave us some ideas of the concern that other people were expressing. Now, we were ordered not to fraternize with the colored people. It was a very strict order, and not allowed to go into the villages either because of VD and so on.
What did you think of that?
Well, we didn't really like it, as a matter of fact. But it had to be accepted. And this is my personal experience now, because I'm not going to enlarge on wider spectrum of what was going on. But I found it after my experience in the Soviet Union, where religion and inequalities, in poverty probably, didn't exist, I found this apartheid extremely strange and also painful to some extent. Because wherever we turned in the streets of Pietermaritzburg, the setup was the same. On the benches, Europeans only signs. Entrances to restaurants, Europeans only. At the bus stops, the blacks used to stand on the side waiting for only the back seat empty before they were allowed to use it. And then I found it rather difficult to swallow. And the other thing which I found also, and I didn't do it myself, but many of my friends, boys, rickshaws. You see, those rickshaws I found a little bit looking inhuman to me, but boys, after having a few drinks, they were delighted to have a go at them. And it was scenes like going downhill, and they would perform almost acrobatics, lift themselves up, the legs up, and making very long strides, and they found it very amusing. But I did not find all this amusing myself, as a matter of fact. I don't know why, but that's my nature. I didn't like this segregation. And some boys, unfortunately, did break the rules. And when we come later on, they had to pay the price for it as well.
They went into the local villages.
And they were things. With women mixing and so on, and some of them managed to get VD in the end. But this business was quite striking in South Africa, and we had a parade, we marched, and they even named one street Poland Street after. We also saw internment camps where many Germans were simply held during the period of war. As we know, the so-called Fifth Column was extremely active right throughout Europe and, of course, even in South Africa, because it was in the vicinity of German colonies in West Africa before the First World War.
Did you and see any of the internment camps?
We only from a distance. Only from a distance. All we saw was just barbed wires, and but we didn't really have any contact whatsoever. We were only told that there were Germans simply interned there for.
By this stage, how aware were you of the Hitler's policies toward the Jews? I
mean, well, at that time,
collected up in Poland.
We didn't have much idea of it at that stage. In fact, it was later on, which we'll come to it, 1943, that it used to transpire what was really happening in Poland with regard to this final solution that Himmler introduced. But in South Africa and during our journeys from the Soviet Union right down to Pietermaritzburg, there was no specific knowledge of any Holocaust element whatsoever.
Idea where you were going to go? You know, where
oh, no, not at all. You see, this is the whole point in the military service. You know nothing, really. You only see what you see in front of you, and you perpetually have to obey orders. But anyway, we gave a performance in Pietermaritzburg, then we gave a performance again in Johannesburg. And in Johannesburg, I remember, I mean, the reception we received was absolutely unbelievable. And I think it was the town hall. It was flooded with people. And we discovered afterwards, because who was grabbing us and taking us to dinner and treatments? It was the Polish Jews, yes. And they were absolutely in tears afterwards when they heard Polish songs and they saw Polish soldiers, and they couldn't believe that Polish soldiers would be in South Africa. And the treatment they gave us was unbelievable, unbelievable. And then Henry and I, we were a little bit naughty, really, because we were performing in another place, and there was a lady who grabbed us, and she said she was half Polish, but she couldn't speak Polish at all. But she took us in a car to a bungalow, And her mother was there. She was Polish. She spoke Polish. And we actually forgot all about our performance, believe it or not. And then she turned on the radio, and our choir was singing. And we, Henry and I, we thought, my God, what's going to happen to us? The punishment will follow, and so on, which it did follow, of course. This young lady, the half Polish, believe it or not, she was so nice to us that I corresponded with her until long time after the war. She used to send me lovely letters and parcels with chocolates and food, and in that time she was most welcome. And until she got married, and then our relationship simply evaporated. But the experience of South Africa was tremendous. First of all, it hit me as a person that by virtue of being white, the Jews really acquire such tremendous privileges. And that's why, vis-a-vis the blacks, I thought it was a little bit cruel, in a way. By virtue just of being white, that you gain such privileges. And South Africa is beautiful, climate too, although at the time we were there, at nights we had extra blankets because it was cold, but during the day it was really scorching heat. Then it all was gradually coming to an end, and we packed our bags and proceeded to Cape Town. And in Cape Town, we started loading a ship, which was an Australian, old, really grotty ship called Rangitiki. And we were loaded, and in fact, at a certain stage, I remember an officer came to Henry and myself. He said that we were not allowed, actually, to go ashore at all. But he said the Yugoslav ambassador made a request that he would like a couple of Polish soldiers. So he said, we thought that you are good-looking and well-behaved, so you better go. So we went to this Yugoslav embassy in Cape Town, and we were received most gracefully by the ambassador, his wife, and two beautiful daughters as well. They gave us tea, afternoon tea, and entertained us. And then the girl said, let's go and walk on the slopes of Table Mountain. So we did. And it was, I mentioned it in my book, it was a little bit tempting when we looked at their beautiful figures and walking, you know, on the slopes of the hills and so on. But eventually we had to get back. And it was quite a pleasant experience, and went back to our Rangitiki ship.
So, I mean, it's how long is it since you were in the Soviet Union?
Well, it was probably 2 months or something, yes.
What a contrast.
I mean, the contrast was unbelievable. You see, it was like a contrast landing in Pahlavi in Persia. We thought it was a heavenly contrast. South Africa, in fact, retained in me really and truly a picture of a different world, a world of a white man enjoying the privileges of being white. And even after the war, as a matter of fact, I applied, I was going to emigrate to South Africa, but for some reasons I didn't. And the whole way of life of white people, the living standards, were, I would say, probably some of the highest you could expect in South Africa. And those blacks were really underdogs in every way and in every form. So we were on our Rangitiki, and then I remember we were due to sail at dawn, very early, and we saw on the quay there were a group of Polish soldiers, and they waved at us, and you could sense, lamentably, there were those who were left behind with VD, you see, as we were told later on. And they looked very pathetic when they waved at us. And we started off at dawn with a terrific convoy, our little ship. And then we had a few destroyers, a cruiser, and even the aircraft was flying over us. And we set off in a convoy, which gave us a tremendous sort of encouragement and protection by virtue of having such lovely ships around it. And as we sailed along, which way we sailed, I had not a clue, but at that time, but we were proceeding. And then next morning, we just got up and we found ourselves completely lonely. Everything disappeared. Our ship was the only one plodding along, and it was cracking all the time. It was an old ship, and it looked a little bit concerning for us. What the hell has happened to all our protection that we had leaving Cape Town? But anyway, as we learned, everything you learned was after the war. That was the policy of the Royal Navy, to scatter the ships because of the appearance of submarines were actually acting from the port of Dakar. This was a French colony there. And as we proceeded, you may not believe it, which we learned the results of it after the war, but one of our, there were three or four ships loaded with our troops, and one was sunk approaching on the level of Dakar. And as we were told after we met some of the survivors, the scenes were absolutely dreadful because they carried Italian prisoners of war and they were heading for Canada. And when they were sinking, I mean, the whole bedlam which occurred, there weren't enough lifeboats. And the privilege were first the sailors and the Polish troops. And some of those, I was told later on, Italians, they were desperately trying to get into lifeboats and they just couldn't. They were chopping their hands with axes and so on. And the scenes were survival of the fittest. But anyway, one of our friends who was on that boat later on, he told me that they were drifting on the Atlantic in their boat. And after a few days, you see, his turn came according to what the chief of this particular boat decided, due to limited supply of food and water and overloading of the boat. They decided to throw overboard some of the chaps you see in the boat. And he said that his turn came, but he clung with his mightiest power he still possessed to a plank under the bench or something to that effect. And they were trying to pull him out, but they just couldn't. And they left him alone. And he survived, because they were picked up later on, and he survived. And when he arrived in Scotland, he was a young man. He had white hair, believe it or not. But this was quite an ordeal for him, you can imagine. But anyway, we passed Dakar, which we were warned that there were submarines in operation and so on. And eventually we arrived at Cardiff, greeted with the usual climate, British climate, drizzle, sort of semi-fog, and for the first time, because it was a tremendous relief for us, there we are.
What did you know about the UK at that time, and what was your attitude towards Britain?
Well, we knew nothing about Britain, really, as a matter of fact, because, you see, in all my education, Britain as such was basically a remote country. The whole influence upon pre-war Poland was from Germany mainly and France. And that's why, for instance, in my schooling, I had had to have Latin or Greek and a foreign language, and most of us would take German or French. But very, very few people ever thought of English. And the only knowledge one had about Britain was the reference was always made, as it still prevails today, it was all England. You see, nobody ever mentioned the Scots or the Wales or the Irish. It was England. Who was England, you see? And that's why later on we discovered that very few people could speak English. Anyway, we arrived in England. We couldn't tell that a Welshman, but we arrived in Cardiff. And those VI ladies were already there waiting with their cup of tea, you see, and which was very friendly, smiling and giving us sort of maternal smiles. You know. We were loaded on the trains and off we went to Scotland.
Do you know what date you arrived in?
Well, I think it was approaching 1942, probably late summer, autumn, you see, late summer. 1942. And we all remember traveling by train. Everything was subject to curiosity. This land of hope and glory to us. We've never seen it before. We never really were interested in it either. And I always remember certain elements of our curiosity, which were rather funny, as a matter of fact. As we traveled, I remember the boys used to say, what's the matter with these English people? Every station we passed, there was a huge sign of Bovril. And we all used to say, haven't they got any other names for the stations? Only Bovril. It was so stupid, really, in a way. Anyway, we arrived in Scotland. It was even worse climate in Scotland. It was raining all the time. We were placed in tents. It was somewhere in Lanarkshire. I don't remember really the place because it was the fields that we landed in. And there it was like a market. Like a market you have. You had officers and NCOs from different branches of Polish armed forces. And they're all sitting in tents and were bargaining, trying to enlist you into different branches of the Polish armed forces. And our group of our boys, you know, Henry and Hubert and many others, there was a group of us, about 18, we all said, all we want is to fly Spitfires. And childish, but there you are. We were adamant about it. But we were told very quickly, we don't want any more fighter pilots. We've got enough of them. So they said, no. They said, you can join the Navy. I said, boys, you know, when you are on the land, there's always a better chance to survive. I was a little bit philosophical about it. Then the greatest pressure we had was from the parachute brigade, you see. And again, we didn't quite like it, you see. And in the end, in a really childish manner and foolish manner, we decided by unanimous vote that what are we going to do? We're going to join the anti-aircraft artillery. If we can't join the Air Force, we'll fire swines, you see, and we'll teach them a lesson. So
that's what you did. I'll stop you just there. Michael would ask me, end of reel 5.